Another jam-packed show on Connecticut Today as we kicked off a brand new month on Monday, June 1st. We talked with an author whose new book takes a look at the future of the workplace. He said about 5% more people will be working at home versus going back to work in a job site after COVID-19. We replayed a conversation from earlier in the day on the morning show between Melissa Sheketoff and Lieutenant Jim Perez of the Fairfield Police Department regarding police tactics and overall policing procedures in the wake of the killing of an unarmed black man in Minneapolis. We also took parts of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus news update, and we spoke with a well-known civil rights attorney out of New York City who gave his thoughts on the George Floyd case. Going back to work, maybe. What is work? What is a job? Why am I here? All those questions being asked as we try to emerge from the coronavirus here in Connecticut, also to just a few miles away from Fairfield County here in New York City. The author is with us of The End of Jobs, The Rise of On-Demand Workers and Agile Corporations. Jeff Wald is the guest. And Jeff, thanks for joining us. And boy, I tell you, this coronavirus thing really has put a new light, a new magnification, if you will, on something that I don't think, Jeff, a lot of people thought twice about.
Well, first off, Paul, thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show.
Thank you.
You are right. Look, there are changes afoot in the world of work, and the coronavirus is accelerating some existing trends that not a lot of people understood.
You even, I know, in the book, talk about the concept of a job or work, which you say is not really ingrained in our psyches for you know, thousands of years. Talk about that.
Well, that is true. I mean, the term job, as we know it today, meaning a career,
yeah,
that only goes back 170 years. That was the first time we used the term job in that context. A job used to mean a very discrete task I was performing for a discrete payment. That went back thousands of years. This notion of being an entrepreneur or a freelancer in our parlance today, that's what people meant when they said job. The idea of this job that we have today is a relatively new concept in the human experience.
You know, I have a friend in the radio business. We worked together for years, Jeff, and he always used to say, and he would smile if I'm probably going to send him this interview, but he always used to say, we don't make the distinction between a job and what we do. And he always talked about people who he knew in this business and others who would love what they did, but they would hate their jobs. And I've kind of started to think about that again, you know?
Well, regardless of whether we love it or hate it, the idea of a job is definitively changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Paul, it used to be that we had this one officer, one office, one manager, 9-to-5 job. That was the job for generations. And that job is the job that is ending. And so I appreciate the book title, you know, is The End of Jobs. It's not to say that jobs themselves are going. It's that job, that one office, one manager, 9-to-5 job. That's evolving into something we talk about in the book as the fluid, team-based, always-on, work-from-anywhere job. And the work-from-anywhere is certainly something that everybody is very aware of right now.
Yeah, and I'm talking to you, obviously, from, you know, Southern Connecticut, the shoreline area, New Haven County into Lower Fairfield County. And, you know, how many thousands of people from Lower Fairfield County head into and out of New York City and North Jersey on a regular basis, Jeff, daily. And now there's open worry and wonder about here and people scratching their heads, you know, with New York City kind of quote-unquote reopening next week. The governor is saying, well, there's about 400,000 to 500,000 people who will suddenly maybe start coming back into the city, whether that's going to have a footing or not in the immediate future again.
Well, one of the trends that is certainly accelerating was this move to more remote work. Prior to this current health crisis, 3% of our labor force worked remotely, meaning more than 50% of their time they did not go into an office. That obviously has increased to nearly 40% of the labor force. I mean, almost everybody that can work remote has worked remote over the last 10 weeks. As we start to get back, you are going to see more flexible work arrangements. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is all of a sudden going to work remote the way we've all been. It just means that people will go in 2 days a week, 3 days a week, and that's in the steady state. Look, the near-term kind of reopening protocols, those are going to be super challenging, Paul. I mean, you know, you think about Manhattan, where I live, and getting people to the top of a 60-story office tower when only one person can go in an elevator at a time. I mean, that's not going to be really reopening. That's going to be waiting your entire day to get to your desk and then immediately turning around and waiting your entire rest of your day to get down.
Sorry, gotta go. It's been a great day, right?
Hey, it's great to see all you guys. Gotta go catch the
elevator. Yeah, see you later. Goodbye. Yeah, you know what, Jeff? I didn't think of the elevator restrictions here. Honestly, I just thought of that. Wow. How is that? Yeah. How can that even work?
When you combine the mass transit that is inherent in a major population center like New York City with the elevators, which is also inherent in the high rises in New York City, the reopening protocols are going to be really, really challenging. And so a lot of companies have said, look, we just don't anticipate coming back this year.
Wow. Jeff Wald is the guest. The book, The End of Jobs, The Rise of On-Demand Workers and Agile Corporations. Jeff, had this coronavirus thing not happened, let's just say we were sailing along on a very normal June 1st, Manhattan, bustling 5th, 6th Avenue, Grand Central, Penn Station, all that, would this have happened eventually? Would this talk of the remote workforce have taken hold or not?
That is a great question. So the reason that remote work had grown so much is that more people want to work this way. But the big constraint on that growth, Paul, was that companies were not of that same mindset.
Why?
Even though all the studies have said, remote workers are more productive, more engaged, they're happier, they cost less, they're more environmentally friendly, everything about it is better. Companies felt that, well, you know, magic happens in the office, or importantly, they didn't have the infrastructure and the policies and the procedures to engage remote work at scale. And that is the crux of your question, because if this horrific thing that we're all going through doesn't happen, they are not forced to put in place the infrastructure, the policies and the procedures to let everybody work from home. And now that they have, genie is out of the bottle. Right. They see that even in the pandemic, when not only are people working, but they're also acting as teachers and childcare. And not only are they, you know, being as productive as they can, but they have no social outlet and a host of other things. They are still on average more productive. And so that is why you will see a huge acceleration in the remote workforce because of this.
Jeff, also the trickle-down effect, the domino effect here, fewer people going into Manhattan or going into anywhere, but particularly, you know, Southern Connecticut into Manhattan or Jersey across the river, whatever, that's lower revenue for commuter railways. It's less revenue for the coffee shops in Grand Central. It's less revenue for the, you know, restaurants in Penn Station. Less cab revenue, less Uber revenue, less revenue on the street carts to buy, you know, those wonderful chestnuts in the city. I mean, this is going to be fascinating to watch.
There are a series of what we'll call multiplier effects every time you start shifting economic activity. But it is a shift, though, Paul. Those people may not be coming into Manhattan as often, but now maybe they're going for lunch in Southern Connecticut. Maybe they are spending more time on other activities in their local communities. The dollars will generally get spent, and the multiplier will hit other places. But there are certainly going to be winners and losers. But let's keep in mind, this is all at the margin. The majority of people, again, once this all ends, God willing, soon, that will still be coming in. This is at the margin. You know, again, 3% prior to the crisis were working remotely. Our predictions now are about 8% post. And while that doesn't seem like that huge a jump, that's 8 million incremental people, but that's out of a workforce of 164 million. So it's a big movement, but not in the context of the entire U.S. workforce.
Jeff Wald is the guest. Name of the book, The End of Jobs, The Rise of On-Demand Workers and Agile Corporations. It will be released tomorrow, Tuesday, June 20th, June 2nd. Jeff, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More with Jeff Wald straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together at 2:16 right here on WICC. As we slowly emerge from our coronavirus slumber funk here in Southern Connecticut, also in major business areas like Manhattan, Jeff Wald is the guest. A few more minutes with him. The end of jobs, the rise of on-demand workers, and agile corporations. By the way, I neglected to say that Jeff founded World Market, an enterprise software platform enabling companies to efficiently organize, manage, and yes, pay freelancers. I like that when I get paid for my freelance work. He founded several other tech companies, one that was sold to Salesforce. Jeff holds an MBA from Harvard, an MS and BS from Cornell. Jeff, what happened with Yale? Did you just like skip over Yale? What about the Harvard? Explain that to somebody in Connecticut here. Right? What's up with that?
Well, you know, look, I applied undergrad. I didn't get in. You know, they didn't want me.
No. Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Boy, I got to talk to my friends at Yale about you. Jeez, like, what did you do, bro? Jeez, you know. Well,
I mean,
at least
I'd be happy to come back right now. I'm ready.
Jeff, you have experience with your software and everything, and also you write extensively, I know, about freelancers. Post-coronavirus, is that going to change in any way? I know there are states who have now a little bit tougher laws against it, but how do you see the freelance workforce shaking out?
Well, Paul, you know, we were super fortunate with Work Market. We raised a ton of money from SoftBank and a few other venture capitalists. We sold the company 2 years ago to ADP. And so being a part of the world's largest HR company now has a lot of advantages. But when I think about the on-demand workforce, it's important to note a few things. One, this isn't some new phenomenon. This has been a part and a very large part of the labor force for generations. And people conflate the rise of Uber and Lyft, that this was a new form of work. Not new. It has been growing, but it's been growing relatively slowly over the last few decades. And when I think about the coronavirus, there are kind of counterbalancing forces. One, there were a lot of companies that were very quickly able to right-size their cost structure, right? Revenue plummeted. It is difficult to get rid of employees. And so the freelancers were the first to go. And so while employment may be down 20 to 30% in the country, the freelance workforce is down 70 to 80%.
Wow.
And it'll be the first to bounce back. And we are actually seeing signs of that bounce back as we speak. So the notion of running an agile corporation, the idea that you can very quickly turn it on and off your costs, will have an appeal to more people post-COVID. That's one point. On the counterpoint, is you have things like California's AB 5 and other states that are creating a very different regulatory environment where companies are getting uncomfortable utilizing freelancers and converting those freelancers to W-2 employees. So the regulation is kind of tamping down the market, but the profit motive is pushing up the market. And we just don't know how these two are going to play out.
Is there could there be a happy medium there between, you know, the states that, like you say, push something akin to what California is doing versus the way it used to be? Or have we now headed down the road, Jeff, of more regulation here?
Well, look, I am always hopeful, always optimistic that there is a happy middle ground. There are substantive concerns by states about workers being taken advantage of. But having met with thousands of CEOs, CHROs that are managing on-demand workforces, I can tell you I have never met a person that said, look, I'm doing this so I could screw the worker and not pay benefits and get the lowest cost. I've never even heard anything remotely like that. I've heard, I want to make sure I'm following the rules. I just don't know what the rules are. And so the ideal scenario would be for the federal government, for the administration to lead, the Department of Labor to lead, and set what the standards are. But this administration has taken a step back from a regulation standpoint, and the states have stepped in, and that has created a patchwork of different rules around the country, and that's just not a great way to run a business.
Interesting. Final question. Larry Kudlow, who's often the front-line guy for this administration, is always asked about jobs, and you're probably seeing the same answer I have. He always says, well, we think as many as 80% of these laid-off workers or furloughed workers are going to come back. We'll still have a problem, but 80% of people who aren't working now will be working by, you know, 3-4 months out. What's your thought on that?
I certainly appreciate Mr. Kudlow's expertise, and he has access to a lot more data than I do. And so I am certainly hopeful. I think that there are certain industries that, before we get to a vaccine, are just going to struggle. I mean, I may be comfortable going to a movie theater, to a live entertainment event, to a restaurant. I'm not 100% sure that everybody will. And when, unless people are fully back in, you just won't need as many people to service them. So I think certain industries are unfortunately in for a long ride, but hopefully this is a V-shaped recovery.
The name of the book is The End of Jobs, The Rise of On-Demand Workers in Agile Corporations. You can get it starting tomorrow, your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, of course, the author, Jeff Wald. Jeff, thank you so much. We appreciate the time, and take care.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it, Jeff. Bye-bye. There you go.
Today, the death of George Floyd and how many cities across the country have now erupted in protests, some pretty destructive. Here in Connecticut, very peaceful, though. For Crime on the Mind this morning, we're going to talk to Lieutenant Jim Perez, of course, of the Fairfield Police Department. Good morning, Lieutenant. How are you?
Good morning. Good. How are you?
Doing okay. So, of course, you know, sort of putting you on the spot, but I think we need to talk about this for sure. In your perspective, you know, this was a pretty blatant police brutality situation. You know, have you watched the video? I'm sure you've watched it enough times by now.
Yeah.
Warranted? Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that this was completely unacceptable. Does anybody, you know, in the Fairfield Police Department, have you guys ever, you know, seen anything like this? A guy just, you know, ramming on somebody's neck, basically?
Right. Yeah, no. What that officer did in Minneapolis is not only it's not only inhumane, it's illegal. Police officers across the state of Connecticut and really across the country are trained. They're trained to be guardians as well as warriors. But I will tell you this, in the guardian portion of it, every single police officer has a responsibility to that. And I don't care what the person did, but when they are under arrest, and no police academy anywhere in the country teaches that you actually put your knee on someone's neck, especially when they're cuffed. So generally what happens is a use of force continuum. That's something that every single police officer is aware of. And this use of force continuum basically guides us in how to use force. And force starts with verbal commands, and then it can go on to either a taser or pepper spray. Then if that doesn't work, it goes on to physical or hands-on. And then if that doesn't work, you know, it just keeps escalating until and including the use of deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
But that force has to be used commensurate with the situation in front of you. So in other words, if the person in front of you has a gun and they're getting ready to threaten someone else, then yes, we're authorized to stop that individual by all means. However, this was a forgery case. So it was a simple, you know, whether it was a fake $20 bill or whatever it was. The bottom line is when you handcuff a suspect, and everybody knows this in the business, when you handcuff a suspect, it's basically over at that point. At that point, it's just a matter of gathering physical control of the person and putting them into the car. I have spoken to many police officers in Fairfield and even outside of Fairfield, and not one of them agree with what happened in Minneapolis.
I mean, how can you? You know what I mean? Like, when you see it,
it's not standard practice.
Yeah, well, and what's crazy about this, Lieutenant, is you're watching, you know, the video, and they started releasing video before this all happened. He was like one leg into the police cruiser. So it doesn't make sense why he was then, even if he mouthed off, you know, even if he did say something horrible, this was an unarmed guy and he was cuffed.
Let's go beyond that. Let's talk about the officers that were around that officer that had his knee in the leg.
Please, let's talk about it.
In my opinion, they're just as guilty as the officer that actually did.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So guess what? You know what that tells me? That tells me there's an acceptance level of that behavior that takes place when they're that callous and cold that they literally walk by, the guy's choking, and no one's addressing it. I could tell you right now, police departments in the Northeast, and I'm talking about from Maine to Pennsylvania, basically, from that whole area, you notice, and I don't know if this is a trend that you notice but or you take hold of, but in this part of the country, rarely do you hear of a police officer getting killed by civilians, right? You know, at least at that, you know, from all this mayhem and madness. And you don't get as many controversial situations. And that's because of the training that we have. In the Northeast, police departments across the Northeast have superior training. That's why anywhere else in the country, when you say you're from the Northeast and you're a police officer, you're guaranteed a position with them of equal or higher standing, you know, within that police department. And that's because of the superior training that we get. And I'll give you an example, Bridgeport. Bridgeport had its own issues the other day, right, where they had several people, about 200 of them that gathered. You know, they tried making their way into the police department in Bridgeport. Then they walked down to McLevy Hall. Then they ended up at the fire department. Then they ended up on the highway ultimately. 200 of them. And there were police officers from all over the area that actually descended down there to help our brother and sister officers in Bridgeport. And everything was done from what I heard and saw, everything was done with not only class and professionalism, but with respect. And guess what? They went up there, they gathered. Yes, they closed the highway down. Yes, that's illegal. But they're allowed to do that for a certain amount of time.
And nobody got hurt.
Water was even provided for them and mm-hmm. food. And then guess what? They went on their way, and that was it. That shows the credibility and respect that there is between the community and policing. But I will tell you this right now. It comes from a top-down environment. So those police officers watching that officer stepping on Mr. Floyd's neck, and then those police officers not doing anything about it, you know what that tells me? Supervision is lacking, and management is indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
Indifferent. So that means it's top-down. You go right to the top, and that's the chief, and you work your way straight down. And every single person within that organization should know that not only is this not tolerated, but you will be immediately facing consequences if something like this happens. And that also goes for those officers that are standing there watching like if, you know, it's a normal, typical Saturday morning.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
No,
it's absolutely ridiculous, and it's unacceptable.
No, it absolutely is. And if you look at the video, I think there were two other officers who were also kneeling on Mr. Floyd while he's on the ground. So it wasn't just one, there was like three of them doing it. So it's
Listen, we deal with, and here's the flip side of it. You have police officers that deal with the very lowest and darkest parts of society that really no one wants to face. So you are able to enjoy a day at the beach. You are able to shop freely without being harassed. You are able to do all those things, have your children play outside because of the work that police officers do across the country. So on the flip side, you have to understand that you're dealing with human beings because we're no different than anybody else. We're not superheroes. We have human feelings. We have, you know, human emotions. We have issues too, you know, like as far as like, you know, personal problems, things like that. The difference is that you need to be able to recognize the vast difference in human mental illness and the vast difference in how people were brought up and how they feel, you know, disenfranchised or whatever. You need to understand that. You need to effectively be able to, in order for you to effectively be able to, to figure things, you know, to work peacefully with people. And I think that what happens is, unfortunately, we have some officers, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it, it's the truth, that either are indifferent to those feelings or just simply don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, you start to get a department that, unfortunately, it spreads like cancer. And then before you know it, it's an accepted practice.
Yeah.
It's an accepted practice that that's how it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think what has to happen is, you know, not only do police officers need de-escalation training, which should be mandatory every single year, and what I mean by de-escalation training, taking a typical verbal incident or assault or whatever and not turning it into a physical one. That's what they need training in. They need training in that area. But they also need dialogue with communities from everywhere, from all around us. Listen, I don't want people to falsely believe that what's happening in Bridgeport could never spill over into Fairfield. Because if you do, you're a fool. You're a fool if you believe it's going to stay in one area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we need to have strong leadership. I think that we need to have leaders with competence, with transparency, with credibility, with respect. All these things have to happen from the top down. And once you start to see that, I've always said this, and it's true, police officers are trained in such a way that they are extremely pliable. What do I mean by that? They can actually adapt very quickly to the surrounding and to the expectations that's expected from them. When you have no leadership or little leadership or bad leadership, this is what starts to happen. And I'm afraid it's only going to get worse unless it changes. And I think the community needs to demand it, and everybody needs to accept it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Lieutenant Jim Perez of the Fairfield Police Department. So, Lieutenant, you and I are talking, obviously, about this situation from a week ago. And it kind of prompts the question as to where do you go from here? Obviously, people are not going to stop protesting. Obviously, we can't say, okay, well, this happened, so we're done. It's in the books. Never again. How do you build the relationship back up between police and the public? I think that this has put police in an incredibly difficult position, and understandably so for some, but for a lot of you, it's not fair. But that's the situation you're in now.
Right, and we have dealt with this for quite a number of years now, and we're kind of sort of used to it. And I'm going to give you a perfect example. After 9/11, everybody loved us. Everybody was our best friends. We were given, you know, food, brought over to headquarters, and the support was incredible, and it really felt good. And I could see that the officers' morale were built up, and they just felt good about what they were doing. When you have that type of psychological feeling permeating a police department, you start, and they know that they have support behind you. They can act not only within reason, but very respectably towards the public, and they know that they have support. Now, on the other hand, recently we had the coronavirus, and it was the same thing. 2 weeks ago, the community was showing an outpouring of support by, you know, baking us cookies, things like that, and that's all appreciated. And then almost overnight, we're on the opposite side of the spectrum. All of a sudden, we're looked at with suspicion, and every single move that every officer makes is being questioned. We have to be very careful because it's a delicate balance between following the rule of law and actually obeying, those laws that were put together essentially by all of us. Because I often say that people behave according to social norms, and every single town is individual and different, and every city is different. But then collectively, we act under the state with general laws that actually everybody can agree with. And those laws have to be kept. So with that said, how do you build relationships with police department again? It's all credibility and trust. It's the community knowing that the police care about them. And then it's the police knowing that the community supports them when they carry out their duties. But I am telling you right now that unless you have leadership in place, and it permeates from top down, it's never going to happen. And that's why you saw those officers walking differently, I believe, in Minneapolis, is because to them it was no big deal. It's acceptable. We're not going to get in trouble. No one's going to get in trouble. Who cares, right? Nobody cares. And so it becomes a matter of accountability. Mm-hmm. Every single police officer needs to be accountable to the leaders of the police department. The leaders of the department need to be accountable to the town and city officials. Those officials need to be accountable to the government and so forth and so on, to the state and feds and everything else. That's how we do it. But we have to do it honestly. We have to have people in leadership that are honest, that can acknowledge that there are issues, and can also acknowledge that there are some exaggerations too, because oftentimes the criminal element, as you see in the riots at night, there's no reason to riot and break into people's stores. There's just no reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's done because these criminals, they hide behind that movement. So there needs to be an honest dialogue between communities and the police, and it has to be continual, and it has to be to the point where there's satisfaction. Now, listen, there's not going to be 100% satisfaction on the community side, because honestly, there are some people, and this can be generational, there are some people that just refuse to comply with authority. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other way to put it. And so those are the people that we have to deal with, or set aside and deal with individually. And you deal with them through, you know, different processes, including mm-hmm. arrest and appearing before a judge and
sure.
all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, it needs to be honest dialogue. There needs to be meetings. There needs to be the public needs to be involved with the police department. The public police departments across the country have historically been a subculture of secrecy. It has for the longest time. And only until it has the police department opened up. How many people, and I'll ask this question to your listeners, how many people have actually, not under arrest, but just on a friendly basis, walked through a police department toward it, actually got to meet the men and women that actually work in them? We're human just like everybody else, but we need help too. And we need help in the form of support, and we need help in the form of training so that we can understand properly what different cultural diversities are and how they're affected, and why certain people act the way they do, especially around authorities. We all know that there are countries around the world that police are not only corrupt, but people are afraid of them.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to figure out a way to actually make them understand that we're on their side. We're actually with them, working together to keep all the communities safe.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's the start of where it should go.
Yeah.
All right. Lieutenant Jim Perez, earlier today from Melissa in the Morning. Good thoughts from Lieutenant Perez.
A lot's gone on in the last week, but it is worth remembering that we are in the midst of the worst pandemic ever to hit our state and this country, and it still requires focus to make sure that we're safe on the back end. The numbers are sort of interesting. Tests performed up a lot, but there was some bunching going on from a few days. Number of positive cases, about 6.5%. So that number is, you know, relatively low over the last period of time. Fatalities, 20. Currently hospitalized, down 27. You can see in the next chart, again, the overall hospitalizations. I know we wanted to talk about this some more. You can see we got up to about 2,000 back April 20th or so, and today we're down at less than 500. So you can see we're down 75%. That speaks to capacity, and that speaks to the fact that we're getting this slowly under control, thanks to a lot of you. Next chart, please. A lot of people have said, hey, let's break out the admissions and discharges. So Josh helped put this together. Since the start of this pandemic, we've had about 9,559 admissions, 7,124 of discharge. So that is, what is that, three quarters plus. Go to the hospital, come out safely. 1981, 1,981 poor souls are not with us any longer who had been hospitalized. And the small number, 454, are still COVID-related hospitalizations. Next chart, I think, is something that keeps coming up. Who should get tested? Can I get tested? How does that work? Well, one, anyone with symptoms gets tested, no questions asked. Anyone who's had close contact with someone who tested positive, get tested or self-quarantine. That's part of what contact tracing is all about. We'll let you know if you've been in contact with somebody who tested positive. We'll make sure you can get a test accordingly. Asymptomatic testing, we're branching that out and filling that out over a period of time. Nursing home and assisted living staff. We've now got the test kits in every single nursing home taking care of all the patients who are there. And we're doing the executive order this evening, which says every single nurse and staff at the nursing homes will be tested now, and they'll be tested on a regular basis going forward. One of the first states, if not the first state in the country, to be able to do that. Correctional facility staff. And offenders. So we started doing that. Most of the offenders have been tested. Staff will be tested again on a regular basis going forward. And our highest risk urban communities, we've spent a lot of time talking about how we're taking the mobile testing, the pop-up testing to the communities, take the test to you, doing everything we can, working with the ministers and others in the community with a trust factor to make sure we want you to get tested. It's for your public health. And it's for the safety of all those around you. That's true of the congregate settings as well. High-risk healthcare workers and first responders. Again, we're making sure that you're safe and everybody you come into contact with is safe as well. And that's all part of our testing that has ramped up dramatically over the last 3 weeks. It's sort of key to our phase two, which starts in and around June 20th, as soon as we start getting up towards 100,000 tests a week. Obviously, we also have to talk about George Floyd and his tragic killing and what has gone on in this state and around our country over the last almost 7 days now. When I found out about the killing, we had a call with the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus the next day. And I said, one of the things that struck me was the police were surrounded by white policemen. And George Floyd was an African American, yet another tragic killing of an African American. And I told the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, I need their help. We have to do a better job you know, of recruiting state police who reflect the diversity of the community. You know, the emphasis we have made in terms of having an administration that reflects our amazing state and all of its diversity, so people can look at their state government, look at their state police, and say, that's somebody who understands me. We've obviously made a big emphasis in terms of recruiting of teachers as well, and making a special emphasis now in terms of judges. And that's what we talked about with the Black and Hispanic Caucus. A couple of days later, you remember we got together with members of the faith community. You know, originally we were going to be there talking about how we're opening up our churches, mosques, synagogues, houses of worship, and slowly getting back to a sense of normal with a big emphasis upon the outside. But as you can imagine, all the faith communities were there, locked arms, just by the tragedy of George Floyd's murder. And we spoke with one voice, and it just reminded me that the message going into the COVID crisis, we're all in this together, and I loved having the faith community there reflecting that same sentiment. You know, then we did know that they were starting to see demonstrations around the country and even in our state. So that's when, you know, Commissioner Rovella and I started talking about Connecticut and what we should do in order to make sure people knew we heard their voices and the power of their message, and yet we also maintain the public safety and peace and community that makes Connecticut special. And, you know, I was just struck by the nature of our police chiefs over that period of time. I was on with Fernando Spagnolo, the Waterbury police chief, and he was there, you know, high-fiving one of the demonstrators, which is pictured. You probably saw the police chief in Stanford took a bended knee in sympathy with all those who felt for George Floyd, his family, and all that that murder represented. Yeah, I did a short tweet just referencing the fact that the police chief in Bridgeport had said, hey, look, I understand the sentiment and grief you are fighting for as part of these protests. And that's and I'd be marching with you as well, but I'm here keeping the peace. And that's the sense of mutual respect that really struck me as we started this long weekend. And it could have been, I saw violence, I saw outbreak, I saw looting going on in other parts of the country, in other big cities in the country. And so far, thankfully, Commissioner, we have not seen that violence. We have not seen that looting here. Overall, very peaceful, a diverse group of people, men and women, Black, white, Hispanic, all in this together for something bigger than themselves. And I just hope to God we can maintain that sense of respect and peace that is so key. But I worry. I worry now. I was on the video conference with President Trump and Secretary of Defense and his Attorney General, and they had a very different message. They said, what's the matter with you governors? How come you're not out there, you know, showing these guys who's boss? If you don't run over, you're going to get run over. How come you're not using the guard? How come you're not arresting more people? How come you're not, quote, dominating the battlefield? And that was the message they said, which is the opposite of what we've been trying to do here in Connecticut as we reach out to our community and work through the meaning of George Floyd's life and sudden death together and what that means. We talked about that a little bit this afternoon with Neil O'Leary and the religious leaders and the chief of police in Waterbury. Waterbury, as you know, there were some demonstrations. They briefly tied up the highways. But I was just so moved by the sense of community there. And I was really moved by the ministers, the legislators, and the police working together from a position of respect. And one of the people that was there on our Zoom meeting talking about Waterbury is our Congresswoman Johanna Hayes. And I wanted her just to say a few things about what we've learned from the George Floyd death and what we can do better. And I think she's an ideal person to give voice to what people are feeling right now. Obviously, she knows something about teaching and she believes in kids. Her husband is a cop in Waterbury, and he knows what's going on. And he was also afflicted with COVID, and now he's back. And I think nobody can speak to the sentiments of what the police are trying to do and what the families are feeling than Johanna. Could you just talk for a couple of minutes, Johanna, about what you heard?
Well, thank you, Governor Lamont, for inviting me to be a part of this press conference. I don't think that I can solve the problem or answer those questions, but I do have a very unique perspective because I am the congresswoman for this district. I also grew up in Waterbury, educated all of my children here, was born and raised. But first and foremost, I am a mother. You know, my husband is a police officer, but first and foremost, he is a father. And I'm a Black woman and he's a Black man. And the events of the last couple days have been deeply painful. Things that we have dealt with in our lifetime, in our community, far too often. I think what we saw play out on live TV, which I would equate not just to murder, but we witnessed an execution, if you will, because we watched the life drain out of George Floyd while he lay on the ground. And we watched other police officers stand by. And that is unacceptable. My condolences to the Floyd family. My heart goes out to his family. But it was just a painful reminder of, you hear a lot about the conversation that Black families have with their children. That doesn't just apply to children. My husband's almost 25 years in law enforcement and on the force. And he knows if we were to get pulled over, he puts his hands on the steering wheel. He turns on the interior light. And he tries to let the officer know that I am carrying a firearm and I am law enforcement, because in the 5 seconds it would take for him to say that, he doesn't want his sidearm to be noticed and a confrontation ensue. We need to have some honest conversations. I've seen what happened in the city. We see protests all over the country. And I think what the frustration is that we're seeing is that for many of these young people, I mean, they're from a different generation, so they don't remember the civil rights movement. They never experienced Dr. King. But what they did experience was when one of their contemporaries took a knee in protest and were told that's not the right way to protest. So it's almost you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And young people are looking for an outlet and they're looking to be heard. And I think that it is our responsibilities to hear people, to not try to explain away their concerns or tell them what they feel or why they should be feeling this, but just to sit and listen. Many educators are struggling as students are asking questions. And what I would say is, if this is the first time you're having those conversations, then you're not doing your job properly. We should be introducing diverse literature and alternative perspectives and allowing students to ask questions. If I were in the classroom, I would have went in my room today, shut the door, and said, let's talk about it. Ask any question you want. Let's open up a dialogue. And while students were doing that back and forth, I would have wrote things down on the board. And then I would have said, okay, now let's go back and talk about these things one by one and create a space that was safe for them to express their ideas, their opinions, their concerns, and just begin to engage. That's what needs to be happening in our community. I hear people say, well, this doesn't happen here, and my community is safe, and our police department is doing a great job. And all of those things are correct. But there are people in our communities who do not feel safe. And we need to hear them and begin to address those things. My husband, I watched my husband struggle on Sunday as our boys came over. I have two boys in their 20s, and they're getting in their cars, ready to leave. And my husband has on his uniform and he's getting ready to go to work to police in the community where he was born and raised. And those conflicting dynamics where either you are Black and law enforcement is against you, or you are law enforcement and you are against the Black community. I know those things are not true because they reside in my home. And the actions of those officers made my husband and all of the other police officers, the good police officers who stand up and protect and serve our communities, less safe. And this idea that there's a few bad apples, this is a profession where there is no room for a few bad apples. We would if the airline said we only have a few bad pilots, we would never accept that. So there needs to be accountability. It has to start at the top, whether it be the president, the governor, the mayor. We have to have people and leaders in our community who believe that all people have value and begin to institute programs and policies that allow a space for those dynamics to occur. This has been a painful week, but so many people have reached out. What can we do different? How can we engage? Not everybody's going to protest. And that's not the only way to make your voice heard. On Sunday, I did not attend a protest, but I did go to church and I worshiped. And my praise was my protest because I prayed for healing for this country and healing for my community. And then I went back to find legislation to reach out to my colleagues. What can I do from the perch that I am sitting at? And I think everybody has the ability to do that. I'll just finish up by saying when I used to teach my students about the Montgomery bus boycott, we would talk about, everybody knows that one, that's a good, you know, the start of the civil rights movement. But not everybody showed up and protested. Some people said, I choose not to spend money in this establishment. Other people sent shoes and bicycles. Other people typed up flyers and sent them out. Other people gave people rides back and forth. So everybody contributed in a different way. And I want to remind people that protest is not the only way to engage in this conversation. And the one thing that we all have control over is our actions. Put yourself in proximity to these communities. Talk to people. Get to know people. Brian Stevenson talks a lot about proximity. And until you get close enough to people to hear them, to listen to them, to go out into their communities, you can't begin to understand the problems that they're dealing with. And I just think that all of the conversations that are starting are a very good starting point to say, although we can't change everything that has happened in the past, but we can learn from those lessons and work together to move forward.
Thank you, Johanna. I just say I've got a son, Andy and I have a son, Teddy, in his 20s, and I never thought to tell him to keep your hands on the steering wheel when you get stopped. And we're all working for a day where everybody knows the police are there to protect them and keep them safe, and we won't have to give a special warning.
All right. Thank you, Governor Ned Lamont, Congresswoman Johanna Hayes, 424. And by the way, for what it's worth, I pounded those rules into my son from the day he got his driver's license. I told him, you pull the car over. If it's at night, you turn the dome light on. You put the car in park. You turn it off. You put your hands on the steering. Actually, you put your right hand on top of the steering wheel. You put your left hand, if you can, out the window. So you're stopped. Your flashers are on. The engine's off. The dome light's on. Left hand out the door, dangling on the side of the door. Right hand on top of the steering wheel. So we should teach all our kids that. I was hammering that into my son from the time he was driving at 17. City-based civil rights and liability attorney. He's a graduate of Duke University and Rutgers School of Law, specializing in police brutality, wrongful death cases, a veteran of TV and radio. He's also been covered in the New York Daily News, the New York Times, and other newspapers. Attorney Richard Bell joins us. Richard, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Oh, good. Thank you for inviting me, Paul.
Richard, let me ask you, at first glance, the breaking news today in this case, Richard, the two kind of 180-degree polar opposite autopsy reports here, what do you make of that? Have you ever seen that before in a case like this?
Oh, yes, very much so. So the family attorney for the Floyd family did the totally appropriate and correct thing, which is to have a private autopsy done, because you have a medical examiner's autopsy. But even if it's not police brutality, in certain wrongful death cases, I will have a private autopsy done, because just because the medical examiner makes certain conclusions doesn't mean that another forensic pathologist may not have different conclusions.
Have you ever seen, though, something so polar opposite this? I mean, we saw the video you did. You probably watched it dozens of times.
And
the county medical examiner says, no, it was probably a heart condition and intoxicants. And then Dr. Bodden and his assistant come up with something, completely opposite, Richard.
Yes, no, I understand what you're saying, but I'm really not that surprised, because these are forensic pathologists. They have opinions. this is not always, you know, black and white. This is very much gray when you do this type of pathological analysis. So for them to come up with today, I and I only heard the report that Dr. Baden, who actually I've both cross-examined and hired, so I know Dr. Baden.
So you know him, okay.
Years, I do. He was also in the OJ case. That was one of his famous cases. And so he came up, I believe, according to news reports, that there was strangulation at the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and asphyxiation. Yeah. What was your first reaction, Richard, when you saw the video?
Oh, I was sickened. I was absolutely heartbroken because, you know, we have to always step back for a moment. That's a human being. That's somebody's brother. That's somebody's son. I mean, that's a human being who got the life squeezed out of him for no reason. It was just absolutely sickening to watch. And it was also just doubly awful because it's another African-American man whose life is snuffed out by policemen using what clearly seems like excessive force.
Let's talk about the two avenues here, Richard Bell, the criminal avenue and, of course, the civil liability here. Explain to my listeners, if they don't quite understand, why those two avenues are not just particular to this case, but in many cases like this, in many cases in the legal profession.
Sure. In all of these police brutality cases and civil rights, false arrest, there's two types of cases. First, let's start with the criminal actions. Okay, so there's two types of criminal actions. We've seen the first one begin, and that's the state criminal action, because only the state has the authority to bring these charges, which they brought for third degree murder, second degree manslaughter. It's a state matter. And so they decided to bring charges where they didn't have to prove intent or premeditation. So apparently, I'm not a Minnesota lawyer, but from my reading, third-degree murder in Minnesota is essentially doing an act that's eminently dangerous and with a depraved mind, meaning it's without regard for human life, okay? And we all see what we see on that video. And then they charge the second-degree manslaughter, and that's a lesser charge. And that's basically they're saying that the officer took an unreasonable risk, and he was conscious in taking that chance of keeping that knee on him all that time of causing death. Okay, so that's the state criminal charges.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, we have the FBI investigating on behalf of the Federal Justice Department what's called a federal criminal civil rights action. And they want to determine if Mr. Floyd's Fourth Amendment right to unreasonable seizure, meaning a seizure of his person being shot, being strangled here, whether that violated the laws of excessive force and whether it was unreasonable from the perspective of the officer. And the catch here is it is intent that has to be proven in the federal criminal action. That's why you don't see that many of those being brought. But we don't know yet. Very well could be brought in the Rodney King case. There was an acquittal in the state, but there was a conviction federal civil rights case. So hopefully that we'll get justice there as well. Now there's the third part, and that's where a lawyer like myself comes in. And that's on behalf of the family, on the Floyd family. Mm-hmm. So they have a right to bring a private civil action. And there's actually two parts to that. One is they can bring this action in state court for the wrongful death, for the battery, for the, potentially they could even argue it was a negligence involved by the officer. That's one part, and that's for his death and his pain and suffering. It's for money damages. Second part is what's called a civil rights action under Section 1983 of the federal law. You can bring it in state or federal court. And that is really interesting because you're saying under this federal statute that the officer, officers in this case, denied Mr. Floyd his civil rights by using excessive force against him. And that's separate claim and separate proofs.
interesting. Richard, hang on. We'll be right back to you because I have a whole bunch more questions. Attorney Richard Bell, based in New York City, civil rights and liability attorney. More with Richard Bell after we check traffic and weather together on WICC. New York-based civil rights and liability attorney Richard Bell continues with us for a few more minutes here on Connecticut Today. Richard, in the material I have here, it says you had a case regarding the sheriff's department in the Bronx, and it sounds like the gentleman involved here went through something similar to maybe we saw with Mr. Floyd. Talk about that case.
Oh, yes. Fortunately for him, he didn't die at the hands of the sheriff, but he easily could have. He actually, this is before the famous Eric Garner case, when you hear Eric Garner saying before he dies, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. So my client was chased off a bus on there was an incident on a bus. It was an off-duty sheriff, and the sheriff, we allege, didn't identify himself. He tackled my 350-pound client who had pre-existing respiratory issues. He tackled him to the ground. He handcuffed him behind his back. He put him on his stomach right on an island on the Grand Concourse. And when my client kept pleading, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, because obviously he's in a prone position, he's got respiratory issues, he's been running, the officer took about three steps and turned around just like a field goal kicker. He put his foot all the way back and did a field goal kick to my client's head. Oh. I know it sounds horrible because it is, and we didn't have a video. What we fortunately had was we tracked down a woman on a stopped bus who observed the whole thing because traffic had stopped on the concourse because of the chase. And this woman happened to be a legal aid lawyer. She was an excellent witness, and she verified my client's story.
Is there, Richard, is there any way, before we talk about the other three officers, is there any way that the accused officer here so far, Officer Chauvin, is there any way he gets off on this?
Oh, I very sadly have to say yes, because...
How?
We have to remember in Eric Garner, number one, in Eric Garner, we didn't even have an indictment from a Staten Island jury, despite what we saw in that video, okay? Philando Castillo, we did have a state action, and that was an acquittal. And Rodney King, we had an acquittal. And you would say to yourself that these cases were so obvious. Well, they are to us, and it seems like it would be a horrible injustice if he got off. But one thing you learn trying cases in the courts, it's human beings, it's jurors, and we can never count on anything being a slam dunk. It's just not that way in the court system.
So if you're his defense, Richard, what could they possibly say? And I know the prosecutors here, in filing that third-degree murder, which is, as you say, unique, it's only one of three states to have that, and the manslaughter, it looks like they're trying to leave his attorney, whomever that may be, no legal wiggle room here. But can you give my listeners any idea of what they may try to argue here?
Well, sure. They're going to pounce on the medical examiner saying that maybe it's the combination of the underlying health conditions and potential intoxicants, and that it was not purely the knee. I mean, it would sound ridiculous to you and I, but it is a defense. They could argue, well, what you don't see on the video is all the struggle going on before, and you can't see other parts of what happened, which you and I have watched that video many times. That just doesn't look like a good defense. And then they're essentially going to say that the officer was not reckless, that his knee wasn't on with such pressure to have caused the asphyxiation. And like I said, that medical examiner's report, although the medical examiner's report does say, according to the criminal complaint, that it is one of the combined effects that what went on, meaning the restraining by the police.
Mm-hmm. Richard, final question here. What is your guess as to what, if any, charges will be levied against the other three officers?
Oh, I would make an educated guess that the three of them have to be charge because they have a duty to intervene. I mean, they're right there. One of them's holding the legs, one of them's holding another part of the body. Well, one of them is hearing the crowd screaming that the man might be dead, that he can't breathe. I mean, you have a duty to intervene. You can't, you're a police officer. That is one of the high duties that you have when you see someone's civil rights being violated and someone having excessive force used upon them, and you can do something about it. You have to do it.
Attorney Richard Bell, New York City-based attorney who specializes in civil rights and liability issues. Richard, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much. We appreciate it, and take care of yourself. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much. And RichardCBellESQ.com if your listeners have any other questions.
All right. Richard C. Bell, ESQ, was an Esquire. RichardCBellEsquire.com. Richard, take care of yourself. Be safe, and hopefully we can chat in the future. Thank you.
I'd love to, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. There you go, folks. Richard C. Bell, B-E-L-L. Richard C. Bell, E-S-Q, short for Esquire. You know what lawyers, the suffix for lawyers. Richard C. Bell, E-S-Q.com. Fascinating stuff.